You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, we learn from a UW... We have the UW economist with us. And we will find out more about the end of pandemic policies and how they could jeopardize historic gains for low-income workers over the last few years. But first, it's time for Wisconsin Life. And here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about an evolving city.
Cities inevitably change through the decades. People move in and out. Businesses come and go. Oftentimes, these shifts are the most obvious in your own neighborhood. Author and historian John Gerda has been reflecting on changes surrounding his childhood home in Milwaukee. He talks about how waves of immigration continue adding to the rich history of this beloved neighborhood.
I've decided what I want to be when I retire. Not a teller of cautionary tales to the young. Not an ache-by-ache chronicler of my ongoing deterioration. And not, heaven forbid, a golfer. What I want to be is something much simpler, an old guy on a bike who rides around looking at things. I might stop once in a while to buy a donut, raise a glass of beer, or fall into casual conversation, but I'll mainly be a witness to change, content to observe the passing scene and enjoy what poet Wallace Stevens called the pleasures of merely circulating. I had a foretaste of that experience on a recent two-wheel tour of my first neighborhood. Until I was 8 years old, my family lived in Layton Park, on the southern edge of Milwaukee's Old South Side. The reason we lived there was generational. My Polish grandparents, John and Mary Gerda, ran a hardware store in the heart of the neighborhood at 32nd and Lincoln from 1915 to 1965. And my father, Art, was the oldest of four kids raised behind the store. When he and my mother, Claire, a farm girl from western Wisconsin, settled in Milwaukee after World War II, it was entirely natural for them to build a little house on South 34th Street, only 8 blocks from the hardware store, and start a family of their own. The Layton Park of Art Gerda's youth had been decidedly mixed. The residents were almost entirely white, but mixed in those days usually had a European connotation. Germans and Poles were almost evenly matched in the neighborhood, some transplanted from the old country, and others born here but still speaking their ancestral tongues. Any business person who hoped to prosper had to have a working knowledge of both languages, and my grandparents were no exception. Fast forward 60 years. My wife Sonia and I lived in Layton Park during the first years of our marriage, just 2 blocks from the used car lot that had replaced Gerda Hardware. The neighborhood was still largely German and Polish, but what a change was on the horizon. In 1980, soon after we left for Bayview, Latino Milwaukeeans made up less than 3% of Central Layton Park's population. By 2010, the number had soared to 73%, and it continues to grow. The changes go well beyond statistics. Sunday Mass at my grandparents' old church, St. Barbara's, is now said in Spanish. Layton Park Lutheran is now Templo Adventista del Séptimo Día, a Seventh-day Adventist congregation. Tebow and Johnson Funeral Home, where roughly half my relatives made their last public appearances, has become Iglesia Cristiana Palabra de Vida, Word of Life Christian Church. Taverns where my grandfather once bent an elbow now play Spanish corridos on the jukebox, and the occasional Mexican flag waves from the front porch of a bungalow that might have been built with nails from Gerda Hardware. Changing neighborhoods provide a wealth of material for meditations on impermanence, but they also underline a fundamental truth about urban life. Everything is in motion. Neighborhoods are like vessels, like shells, built by one group and inhabited by a succession of others. Each group makes its own memories and then moves on. As pop singer Jewel succinctly put it, everything's temporary if you give it enough time.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee-born writer and historian. He's written 23 books on the history of the city. His most recent one is Brewtown Tales, More Stories from Milwaukee and Beyond. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, a new analysis finds that the lowest 10% of wage earners gained the most during the pandemic. From 2020 to 2022, wages grew nearly 6% for our lowest income workers, and that's adjusted for inflation. At the same time, but at the end of the pandemic era, government spending and the Federal Reserve's current push to curb inflation may claw some of those gains back. We're talking about wages and whether the increase in income for those who need it most is sustainable. And we'd like to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. How have your wages changed during the pandemic? And how has inflation impacted your life and your bottom line? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Tim Smeeting is the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is also the former director of the Institute for Research on Poverty. And Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Tim.
So we had a 6% increase for the lowest 10th percentile of wage earners. But at the same time, we saw a 5% decrease for the 90th percentile of wage earners from 2020 to 2022, largely encompassing the worst portions of the pandemic, and that's adjusted for inflation. What happened to wages over that time? What's the cause of this?
Well, that's a good question. A couple of things. First of all, we had a very tight labor market. Demand exceeded supply, and the pandemic wore down, and people wanted to go out. So in particular, restaurants and bars were hard hit. There's wages were too low, and all those people got a boost. But you got to remember, the base was really low, so it's not that big a jump. It still was good, and it still is, but you can walk around this whole city and see restaurants are open Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night, only or limited hours because they can't find workers. At the top, what happened was a little bit of a compositional change because a lot of older, better paid workers retired and younger workers came in. So that pulls the wages down. It's still a much, better deal.
Is this sustainable? Is this something we're likely to continue to see with a tight labor market?
As long as we have a tight labor market, yes. The good news is that there's a lot of demand for low skill workers beyond bars and restaurants now. The expansion of infrastructure and construction, putting in all those Wi-Fi lines so more people can work at home and things like that all around the state. Those are all offer good jobs for low-skilled people. And the other thing is, however, though, the big problem with all this is there's going to be a lot of cutbacks in child care support. So that's going to make it harder for women in particular, or mothers or fathers, to go out and work because part of the budget deal is going to end up cutting discretionary spending on programs like, child care support and the WIC program and all of that.
So from your perspective in terms of public policy, what role has public policy played in lifting up the wages of the lowest income earners?
Well, it played a role in a lot of ways. We had a child tax credit for 1 year, a refundable child tax credit in 2021. This was a godsend. It helped low-income parents tremendously. It would be there every month, but then we did away with it. During that period, people didn't stop working. They went out and worked more. They used some of the money they got from the child tax credit to buy child care, and that was subsidized further, too. But that's not to mention the fact that everyone was covered by Medicaid with no questions. So they had health insurance. You had access. You didn't have to find a job that had good health insurance. You were covered. Now that's all going away right now, actually.
Yeah, I was going to ask, some of the debt ceiling deal that was signed into law over the weekend looks to claw back some of the pandemic relief funds, but how much of those pandemic relief funds are the reason we've seen the lowest income earners seeing more wealth for themselves and their families?
Well, some of it is that clawback. It turns out, pardon my French, we farted a mouse. The whole thing ended up not saving a lot of money. The SNAP program, we added more veterans, but we told 55-year-olds you had to work, and by the time the math got done, CBO says we're going to spend more on the SNAP program. We cut the IRS's ability to chase high-income tax cheats. And the CBO says that's going to cost us money because we would have gotten back the return. So really what it was about, unfortunately, is there's a lot of people out there who just do not want to increase taxes in any way, shape, matter, or form. And the fact of the matter is the government can't go on spending 25% of GDP and financing only 18% of it. There's a 7% gap. We have to do something.
But the something has always been cuts. But what you've alluded to now is some of the public policy we've seen in the spending from government during the pandemic is some of the reason those who needed it most found the most during the pandemic.
Absolutely. Now, I mean, we stepped on the gas maybe a little hard, all these emergency income payments or whatever. But those boosted demand, but demand has kept on going.
But so has inflation, though, Tim, and I want to get to that
inflation is still there.
I will ask our guest, Tim Smeeting, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, but I'll also ask you how inflation has impacted your bottom line at 1-800-642-1234, and we'll continue our conversation about the historic narrowing of the wage gap that we've seen during the pandemic and how that might not last. That's next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn. And coming up tonight at 6 on 1A Plus with Jen White, is there a future for horse racing in the U.S.? The industry is facing new scrutiny after 12 horses died at Churchill Downs. Belmont Stakes is this weekend. Racegoers, owners, and the experts all weigh in tonight at 6 on 1A Plus. Right now, we're talking about how pandemic-era policies reversed the decades-long trend of a widening wealth gap. Our guest is Tim Smeeting, the Lee Rainwater Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs and Economics and former director of the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. Still time for your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or your comments about your economic situation, 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. So, Tim, the impact that inflation has had on our spending ability and our budgets?
It's mixed. It depends on what you buy and where you get your money. Part of it, though, these same low-income workers who have been gaining in terms of salary, we're finding out that if people borrow on credit cards, you're borrowing at 28 and 29% now because they've shoved the interest rates up so high. I think the Fed's going to take a pause next month, and I think they should, to wait and see, you know, how things work their way out. One of the things that's going on is there's a surge of immigrants, people already in the country. We've stopped them at the border in the last week or two. But there's 2 million people seeking asylum in the country who want to come and want to work. And we're making jobs more available to them. And they're taking whatever work they can get. And that means more supply of labor, which lowers prices, lowers wages somewhat. Mm-hmm. But still, demand exceeds supply so much, there's so much chance to move up that people are actively thinking, well, why do I want to work weekends and nights at this bar or this restaurant? I can get a regular day job. I can see my kids. Maybe I can get some childcare. I'll work, maybe I'll go be an apprentice somewhere. I'll do some construction, whatever. And I think that's all good.
With your expectation of the Federal Reserve pressing pause on trying to curb inflation, do you expect inflation to somewhat slow here going forward?
We can hope so. Part of it is oil prices. The OPEC's on its last gasp, and they're holding back. That's part of it. Food prices, too. In the summer, they should ease with more supply and more opportunity. The rental thing is tough, depending on if you're an owner, it's fine. If you've got a fixed mortgage, especially if you got your mortgage before inflation took off. But if you want to buy a house, it's really hard. And so it depends where you are.
And isn't that buying a house the way you build equity?
Well, first of all, first thing you need to do is develop emergency savings. You have to have that. And that's one of the things that child tax credit gave families with kids. There was money you'd have some money for an emergency. The earned income tax credit does that too, but you only get that back in February or March, and then there's nothing more after that. But if you can make sure you don't have to go run that credit card at 29%, or make sure you don't need a payday loan, then you can start thinking, well, maybe we can start saving to buy a house. Maybe we should start saving for retirement. Take that IRA offer or that 401k offer from your employer. That all looks good if you keep working. And, by the way, if you don't have a big student loan debt, which creates other things.
Well, that is a recent story as well, as some student loans are going to have to be repaid here going forward.
It's time to start repaying them.
And that's not, as you see it, doesn't help the economy, fuel the economy?
Well, it hurts it. I mean, the people who can't afford to pay their student loans are people who can't afford other things, too.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll get some relief, but I doubt it. I think that the Supreme Court is going to tell Congress that if you want to give $500 or $600 million back, you have to pass a law. You can't just do that by fiat.
Tim Smeeting, you're the former director of the Institute for Research on Poverty, and it's a big, broad question, but I would ask you to boil it down. What are the causes of poverty? What creates it in the United States?
In the United States, a lot of different things. One in particular is that earned income isn't enough, particularly for single parents. Two parents have a better chance.
So we're talking about wages. We've been talking about the lowest income wages, and the lowest income wages would have it the hardest. But across the board, you're saying that we're not making enough money to alleviate poverty in this
country.
Say
you were making $8 an hour, tending bar or something.
No.
Increase it by 50% to $12 an hour.
Still a struggle.
That's not enough. Right. That's not enough for one person working full year full time to pull their family out of poverty. You need two people, and then you need to get lucky with having health insurance and finding a place you can afford to live.
You mentioned child care a couple of times.
Oh, yes. Always child care. And child care is one of the things that's really at risk now because we need more appropriations. Biden had plans for expanding child care, but a lot of that's going to be cut back because it's discretionary spending, which is what the only place that Congress has left. Now, what we should do, what we should have been doing all along, is not taking Social Security off the table.
What do you mean?
Biden, in his State of the Union address, just said, you're not going to do anything with Social Security.
Cuts to Social Security?
Yes, cuts to Social Security. But you have to understand how, okay? You can institute cuts that take place 10 and 15 years out and save money on the budget. What you have to do is increase revenues by raising the ceiling on those rates back to cover 90% of wages and pay well-to-do retirees 10 years out a little bit less. That could have been done.
Okay.
That would have brought those numbers way down.
Tim Smeeting, you talked about the less than minimum wage worker making $8 an hour at a bar and having it bumped up to 50% to $12 an hour, and how little impact that might have on the bottom line of that person, their income. But what about taxing the top 10% and what impact that has on their lifestyle and ability in the United States?
That is what we, of course, should be doing. And Biden is trying to do that, but he's not going to get away with it. But. The Trump tax cuts expire next year. Trump gave big cuts at the very top in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, TCJA, of 2017. In 2025 or 2026, those expire.
Don't we all benefit those rates from those go back cuts? Up. Those were the arguments that were made, Tim.
Right. Trickle down. Kenneth Galbraith once said, trickle down means that if you feed the horses enough, they'll leave something on the road for the sparrows. That's what trickle down. Building from the bottom up or the middle up is the new thing that Biden is trying to do. And so he's trying to preserve and help the middle class, particularly those, you know, people who borrowed money who didn't get a bachelor's degree afterwards, who went to a for-profit college and ended up with a big bill and no return in terms of earnings. And the infrastructure expansions and those sorts of spending are really going to help them. We need a lot of people in construction and a lot of people doing applied trades. There's big chances for that over the next few years all over the country.
You're a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, Tim Smeeting, but I hear a lot of connections between the causes of poverty and public policy, that public policy is what, to some degree, dictates poverty in America.
Yeah. You can't work alone isn't going to do it particularly for single parents, for most people.
You couldn't work hard enough to get yourself out of it.
Most poor people work. The vast majority of people who get the SNAP program work. Single parents work more than married parents in our country. It's just that you don't have enough hours and enough wages without some help with child care or something. Imagine you're paying $4 an hour for child care. What's that do to you?
$4 an hour?
Yeah, that's cheap. Yeah.
So if you were to, if you were to take public policy to use it to alleviate poverty, what would be Tim Smeeting's top priorities?
Well, first of all, childcare, make childcare available. When we did W-2 here, Tommy Thompson had childcare available and Medicaid available. So you could go to work, you wouldn't lose, you would get childcare support. We need more childcare slots for low-income people, more subsidies for childcare so they could work, okay?
Yeah.
We need to allow them to move into better jobs. A tight labor market will continue to do that.
Okay.
Move into better jobs.
But that doesn't sound like a public policy issue then.
Oh, it is if you can help people get retrained and get ready to do these jobs.
What about health care?
That's a really tough one. What's going to happen is right now a whole bunch of people are being shed from Medicaid. Not so much kids, although if they cut the CHIPS program and other programs, or if they temporarily toss you off and it takes time to get back on, kids are going to have trouble. And we know the youngest kids need health care the worst. They need it. They need those original checkups. They need to know when they're having a problem. They need to be ready to go to school and so forth. And all of that's threatened by this big shuffling that's going on right now. Places like ABC Health in Wisconsin are helping a lot. But some people who are actually eligible will be temporarily derailed from health care. And that's probably going to create a lot more people at the emergency room and a lot more health problems that could have been prevented that won't be prevented.
Hey, Tim, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for spending yours with us this afternoon.
Thanks, Tim. Nice to be with you.
Tim Smeeting is a distinguished professor of public affairs and economics at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, talking to us about the historic wage gains made by low-income workers during the pandemic and how likely we are to see that persist. Join us again tomorrow afternoon on Central Time from 3 until 6. Now, coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then the National Weather Service and an ag educator discuss ongoing abnormally dry weather conditions we're currently seeing across about two-thirds of Wisconsin. What does that mean for our farmers, and what can we expect for our fall harvest? That's next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Ukraine is reportedly preparing a counteroffensive to push Russian invaders back. We'll talk to an armed conflict international relations expert about the strategy and the U.S.'s role in it. First, U.S. Drought Monitor says nearly all of southern Wisconsin's under abnormally dry conditions right now, and the National Weather Service says the area is facing elevated fire conditions due to the dry air and gusting winds. What's our summer weather looking like? When will we see some substantial rain? And will it be enough to come to the relief of crops across our state? We'd like you to join this conversation, especially if you are a farmer or involved in agriculture, and let us know what you are seeing early in this growing season. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us ideas@wpr.org. Joining us is Tim Halbach, a warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. And Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Also our guest this afternoon, Jerry Clark. He's the UW Extension Crop and Soil Educator for Chippewa, Dunn, and Eau Claire counties. Jerry, welcome back to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Lee.
Tim, I'm going to start with you and look at our weather. The U.S. Drought Index says we're roughly two-thirds of Wisconsin's under some abnormally dry weather conditions right now. What is that looking like to from where your perspective, and what do you expect to see going forward?
Yeah, a lot of this has all happened within the last month or two across Wisconsin. The southern part of the state, it's been more so a two-month thing where mid-April, it seemed like the rain just shut off, or any of the precipitation that we had going for us just ended. We started getting a lot more of these high-pressure systems coming in from the northeast and from southeastern Canada, which is, it's made for nice conditions if you're not a farmer or somebody like that, but it's led to some fairly dry conditions. So in the southern part of the state, it's been a little bit more pronounced to begin with. We're about 4 to 6 inches of precipitation below normal for the last 2 months. The northern part of the state's a little bit less, but some of that was just from the later part of April where they were able to keep things there. So, you know, with the dry conditions, we start providing feedback to the drought monitor to let them know, you know, here's what we're hearing. These are what some of the rivers are doing. It's not just how much precipitation deficit we're seeing, but everything kind of put together. So that's where it's been beneficial to hear things from farmers, you know, things like, you know, the irrigation ditch that I normally use to pull water from starting to run out of water. That's the kind of stuff that we need to hear about so that we can let the drought monitor folks say, you know, hey, things are maybe a little bit worse than what we're saying here.
And Tim, how do weather conditions, and for that matter, our irrigation at this point, our rivers and streams, how do they look compared to previous years? And are we seeing trends and changes to our weather conditions this time of year?
So coming out of winter, the rivers were actually pretty high up because we had a pretty good period of precipitation to start the year. To the point where the drought from last year was erased and we had no more drought conditions, at least through the drought monitor. And the rivers were pretty decent. And actually, you know, for a period we had flood warnings. Mississippi was at record levels. Mm-hmm. And that all kind of ended when we got to April. So, you know, what we've been seeing is just this, you know, this change that's happened now. So with the precipitation falling off and not really getting these good periods of rainfall where this time of year we're expecting an inch of rain a week, that's leading to these drying conditions, you know, happening a lot faster.
And we, yeah, so Tim Halbach joining us from the National Weather Service in Milwaukee, also our guest Jerry Clark from the UW Extension. And Jerry, I'd ask you, I mean, we did see some rain earlier this spring, but it has seemed to dry out, particularly in southern Wisconsin. And what does this mean for farmers across the state?
Yeah, we had a good planting season, a little bit behind early on, but then with this dry spell that's been in northern Wisconsin here for at least 3 to 4 weeks now, this is where we're starting to see the effect of that dry weather, and the planting season got caught up. So emergence was pretty good for the crops that were spring planted, your small grains, alfalfa, corn, soybeans. Seemed like they came out of the ground pretty well, and we had a nice start to the year. And now, even though we're early, we can start to have a little concern simply because we've got dry conditions, especially on those lighter soils where they're a little bit more sandy. Even those fields may be irrigated and have potential for irrigation. Even the heavier soils that we see across a lot of the dairy belt in Wisconsin had a nice crop of alfalfa, at least an average crop, but now what's the future going to hold to get that second crop going? So right now the crop, I think, is under some moderate stress. We're not in a critical period yet because the crop is a little younger, a little smaller in terms of the grains. But that alfalfa and hay crop is the one we could be getting concerned about simply because there's no soil moisture to get that second crop up and running.
And Jerry, what does the drier conditions mean for some of the herbicides that are used by farmers?
Yeah, it's a good question, Lee. It's one that we kind of forget about that, you know, we need moisture to activate those herbicides. So they can be put on the fields we call them a pre-emergence herbicide, where they're put on before the weeds emerge, but they need water to activate. And so without the rainfall, the efficacy of these herbicides after a few days or about a week to 10 days, they can start to lose that efficacy, and you need a good rain to kind of move those herbicides down into the soil profile a couple inches where they can do most of their work to prevent those weeds from emerging. So that's where we've had a concern early, is that we were so dry right after the corn planting season that many of these herbicides may lose their efficacy simply because they don't have the moisture to activate. And that's where we've seen the irrigation systems, especially in Dunn and Chippewa County, being run early. It wasn't because of the of the crop needing moisture, although that's helpful. It was more to get those herbicides activated so the weed control can be there throughout the season.
Jerry Clark, UW Extension crops and soils educator for Chippewa, Dunn, and Eau Claire counties. Also joining us, Tim Halbach, who is the warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. We invite you to the conversation with your questions for our experts at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or your observations on what you've seen so far in this spring weather and what you might expect come summer. Tim, what will the effects be on the state if these dry conditions continue? What could we see?
So that's something that we've been looking at quite a bit now, is trying to see, you know, are there any big rainfalls coming down the pipeline? And at the moment, we're not seeing a whole lot of that. So when, we're trying to look at a week or two out, we maybe have something this Saturday that comes through. It's the heaviest rainfall right now is going to be painted across the central part of the state. And then going through the following week after that, there's not a whole lot. So the other things we start to look for as well is heat. If we have any big heat waves, that can make things go faster in terms of the drought and just some of the conditions that we're seeing. And thankfully, we're not looking at, 90 to 100 degree temperatures or anything like that over the next few weeks. But if we continue on these dry periods where we have week after week where we're not getting, that half inch to an inch or more of precipitation, that's just going to set the stage for July when, our temperatures peak from, basically the whole month is anytime that we can get some of those big heat waves. So those are some of the things that we're keeping an eye on as we go through this time frame.
Jerry Clark, what's the rule of thumb here? Where's our corn supposed to be by the 4th of July, up to our waist or somewhere around there? And so when you hear the forecast from Tim in the weeks to come, what's that sound like to a farmer in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's a little concerning since there's a longer, dry spell, maybe not hot. And again, that's one thing. The temperature will drive a lot of that evapotranspiration, we call it, what's pulled out of the ground versus what the crop uses. Also, in addition to what evaporation occurs. But I think this longer term dry spell, I think right now is where the corn crop will use, about a tenth of an inch. It's younger. If we're looking at corn and soybeans, it's a little younger. It'll pull out maybe a tenth to a tenth of an inch of precipitation or water each day. So as we pull, 10 days worth of water out, that's an inch of rain that needs to be replaced. And if we don't get that, that's when we continue to see the stress. So there are, as long as it's cooler, that'll help, but we still have a dry soil condition and that's not going to get any better. So that evapotranspiration that occurs as the crop pulls out water plus what it loses in evaporation, we need to replace that. And if these spotty rains that occur, if you're the farmer that happens to catch that half inch to one inch rain that might be coming through, that's good news, but your neighbor may miss that. And so what we kind of need right now is that overall kind of drenching rain, nice and slow for over a couple days. That'll add an inch or two to our soil moisture. So I think as a farmer out there, that's the concern, is that as this continues along, especially dairy farmers where they're really going to rely on maybe that alfalfa crop or a hay crop to continue to have feedstuff for winter, we're going to probably see that those successive crops, especially that second and third cutting, if this occurs, continues, that there's going to be high feed prices along with, a lack of feed out there in general.
Ooh. UW Extension crops and soils educator for Chippewa, Dunn, and Eau Claire counties, Jerry Clark, joining us, along with a warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service, Milwaukee, Tim Halbach, also our guest. And we invite you to this conversation about our upcoming summer weather, our forecast, and our fall harvest. What do you see out there? And if you're a farmer, we'd love you to join our conversation as well at any time. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us. Ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue our conversation next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation on the abnormally dry weather around Wisconsin we've seen so far, at least in the latest weeks of spring, and what that may portend for summer as well as our fall harvest. Our guest, Tim Halbach, warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Milwaukee, and Jerry Clark, UW Extension crops and soils educator for Chippewa, Dunn, and Eau Claire counties. We invite you to our conversation as well. How does it feel Wisconsin weather is changed? How do you feel Wisconsin weather's changed over your time here? 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, where Mark in Richland Center standing by. Mark, good afternoon. Mark, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, good afternoon. What are you seeing where you are?
We're just running into dry weather like you're talking about, and we've missed all the little pop-up showers here for our farm. So we're struggling, I would say. Some of the pastures are starting to get pretty brown, and we graze our cows, so we need the pasture out there. Plus, it's been good for getting crops in because we're ahead of schedule a little bit, but there's not going to be much of a second cutting.
And what can you do as a dairy farmer, Mark, to try to mitigate some of this drier weather? Is there any steps you can take above and beyond praying for rain?
Sometimes we put some corn on hay ground after we take the first cutting off, and we actually bought some sorghum sedan grass that we're going to plant instead of the corn, which is going to be a good solution maybe for August or so. We'll graze the cows on that to try to get some forage for them, but it's going to hurt over the winter just because we'll be not having that corn to feed. Over the winter, we'll have to buy some corn instead of having that feed. So hopefully we can get through it. And where some of the cows, we've kind of set up a cull program where we cull a couple of the extra cows maybe that we're not going to, that aren't quite as good, just so we can get the cow numbers down so we have enough feed.
Yeah. Mark, I appreciate you sharing your story. I wish the very best for you and your farm. And, you know, we are all counting on you, needless to say. And Jerry Clark, when you hear the story of Mark in Richland Center and his dairy farm there, what does this mean? What do you hear about what to expect for the rest of this summer and what we can do besides pray for rain?
Yeah, those are what Mark mentioned. Those are some great strategies that you have to, you know, start planning ahead depending on how long dry spells occur. And, you know, managing that feed inventory and livestock, that's a big part of it. We kind of know as an estimate, farmers have a great feel for average yields and what they need for feed for the year to get their cattle and livestock through the winter. And these strategies where, yeah, you may have to reduce numbers, sometimes purchasing feed, emergency forages are a major part of it. So depending how long this lasts or what happens, you know, over the next, especially the next month to 6 weeks, when we know what the corn pollination period looks like and those kind of things, emergency forages sometimes come into play where we, like Mark said, sorghum, sedan grass, we look at some of the small grains. Some people will start to look at buying the neighbor's soybean field for maybe, or some soybean acres to chop for forage and feed. So there's all kinds of alternatives that will start to go into play, or some planning, the longer that this dry spell continues. So farmers are always on top of things as far as planning ahead and knowing what they need. And Mark's a great example of some of those alternative strategies.
Yeah, Mark, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. And Tim, I'll ask you our forecasts have become so good that we don't expect the weatherman to be wrong very often anymore. And you've taken us out a few weeks, but can you take us our weather out any further than that for Wisconsin and give us some perspective on what we might expect this summer? Or is that too much to ask with the models that we have right now?
Yes. While we were at break, I was trying to look at some of the models that we use that show the trends in the longer term period. They're less reliable. You can maybe start to nail down trends, but being able to pick out, you know, what area is going to get hit for, you know, thunderstorms and things like that is really difficult for the summertime. So I'm not going to go out on a limb and say, you know, get hopes up one way or another. But, you know, the next 2 weeks, the models have gotten pretty good that we can at least see those kind of trends. And right now it's looking like the weekends the next two weekends. So this one Saturday, there's a cold front that comes down, and then it looks dry most of next week, and then maybe another stronger storm system for the following weekend. But you know, whether that's a line of thunderstorms that gives you an inch of rain in an hour, or you know, it's not going to be one of those long drawn out rains. But just like anything with the forecast, the closer you get to when that event's going to occur, the more accurate that's going to be. Right now, it's, you know, the further out in time you go, the more error shows up in those forecast models. But at least the general trends we can start to get down. So,
and Jerry Clark, if our soil gets so dry, is there a chance we could risk some flooding for farmers once the rain finally does come this summer?
Yeah, absolutely. Like Tim said, I think if we get those, you know, intense thunderstorms that kind of blow through in an hour or two and really don't soak the soil, that's where we can have those flooding events. I think most of that water will move off. The ground gets so hard and the infiltration just doesn't occur very quickly once those soil particles tend to get a little closer together, dry up. It takes a little bit more soaking in order for that infiltration to occur. So we can get an inch of rain, but does that mean an inch went into the soil? Probably not when it comes that quickly. So that's where we do need those, you know, I guess Tim knows better than I, the low pressure system that kind of hangs around for a couple days and just kind of drops some slow, easy rain over several days is kind of what we're back into. It's kind of hard to believe since we had a flooding, you know, especially in Chippewa Falls area here in Chippewa County, we had flooding 6 weeks ago right downtown, and now we're talking about dry weather and a drought.
Those sorts of extremes, Tim, is that something we're likely to see more of with weather patterns in Wisconsin?
Well, I mean, so right now you're seeing what the situation is. It's been a blocking high pressure system is what's basically been controlling our weather pattern for the last month or so. So that's why we've had all these cold fronts coming from the northeast, as opposed to your standard, you know, you get the warm air and then the cold front comes through and mm-hmm. then it gets cold behind it. This also, you know, with the weather pattern, the way it's been, the fire weather, I know we're not onto that as much with the farmers, but fire weather has become a bit of a concern. There's been a lot of wildfires in southeastern Canada, which normally we get them up in the western or northern part of Canada. But lately, with this flow that we've been in, we've been getting the smoke and everything coming down into Wisconsin. And if you've seen anything on the East Coast, the New York area has been really hit hard with some of the smoke that's come from that. So that's another thing that we're keeping an eye on with just the fuels. If we do get a windy, dry, hot day, that we could have some elevated fire risk going through the next few weeks here too. So it's more so, just to answer your question, the weather pattern we're in with the, you know, what we're in right now, and you know, whether you see more of those in the future, that's, you know, part of, you know, with the climate change, the difference, you know, climate shifting northward, maybe we're a little bit more into the ridges a little bit more often, but this is kind of a unique pattern that we've been in lately.
So that's somewhat reassuring, I suppose. And Jerry Clark, we've got about a minute left here, but what can we expect for the rest of the summer for our farmers, and what more can they do to protect their crops and protect their herds before we get to a fall harvest and get through the growing season?
Yeah, I think some of that management comes into play as this plays itself out. That's where more decisions will be made regarding if they need to go with emergency forages or try to replant some of the, you know, later on. If we need forage, still corn planted into July still produces more tons of dry matter than some of the emergency forages. So the ability to plant corn late is still there if this is continuing. But if the soil is dry, then you probably want to save the money and maybe have to put it towards feed or purchasing, especially if you're a livestock or dairy owner.
So without some real rain here in the future, farmers might be faced with some real tough decisions going forward.
Absolutely.
Hey, Jerry Clark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Tim Halbach, thanks to you.
Yeah, no problem.
Jerry is the UW Extension Crops and Soils Educator for Chippewa and Dunn and Eau Claire Counties. Tim Halbach, the Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. And we've been taking a look at what we can expect from the growing season, our fall harvest, and what our farmers need from our weather going forward. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a Wisconsin political science professor and armed conflict expert about the war in Ukraine and a potential counteroffensive to push Russia back. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.